on the bed, but her neck was bent awkwardly as she stared at the book in Davoud's hands. She said nothing. Her face held no expression whatsoever, and yet he felt a rush of shame. Anila either didn't notice or didn't care as her gaze slid from the book to the doorway. She watched it for a time, her eyes calculating, hungry, as they had been when she had questioned him day after day about his magic out in the desert. Anila? She didn't respond, didn't so much as look at him. Anila, please, speak to me. Her only reply was to give the book one last glance, then return her gaze to the ceiling, wincing from the movement. Her look of hunger faded, and then she was back to the same Anila he'd known these past many weeks. He was about to plead again when a shadow flitting behind the curtains caught his eye. He moved toward the window. There was a firefinch in the ornamental fig tree outside, a bird with a vivid yellow breast that burned its way up toward the bright orange feathers along its head. He wouldn't have given it a second thought if it hadn't been acting so strangely. Most such birds would flit about, hop from branch to branch. They would blink, take in their surroundings, flutter about, and little more. Firefinches were nervous birds. But not this one. It rested stock still, and seemed to watch Davoud as he came to the patio doors and opened them. It turned its head once as he walked over the brick toward the tree.
"What are you about, then?" he asked.
It remained perfectly motionless, for all the world one of the preserved birds the travelling shows sometimes brought to the city. It was on the lower branches, close enough to touch. Only when Davoud took one more step toward the tree and reached for it did the bird take wing. In moments it had flitted up beyond the walls of the small patio and was gone. Chapter 5 Cheda stared into King Onur's eyes. She was doing her best to control her fear, but felt exposed and helpless without her ebon blade. Onur snapped his fingers at Beryl of tribe Salmuk, who threw River's daughter to him. He caught Cheda's sword and pulled the blade free of the lacquered wooden scabbard. It looked tiny in his massive hands as he inspected the design near the crossguard, a heron wading along a reedy riverbank. An expression of curiosity overcame him, and then a look of understanding, as if the sword's identity had told him all he needed to know about Cheda and how she'd come to be there.
"Well, well."
He lifted his eyes and stared at her, his stony face smiling in that grimy, lecherous way of his.
"A maiden lost from her flock."
Beryl and the others shared a glance. One placed a hand on the grip of her sword. Onur waved her away.
"She's harmless enough."
Then he turned and trudged toward the nearby tent with his characteristic limp.
"Come, Chedamin."
Far out in the desert, Kerim pleaded with her.
"Flee! Flee! You must flee!"
His terror for her was so strong she nearly complied. Part of her wanted nothing more than to run, but she knew Onur's presence here represented a shift in power in the desert, and she'd be a fool to let this chance go, danger or not. So she followed Onur into the tent, watching him carefully for signs of aggression, wary as well of the four women standing beside the wooden throne near the back of the tent. The women, all with shamshirs at their side, were dressed like blade maidens. From the battle skirts to the boots to the braces and the boiled leather sewn into the fabric. Except the cloth wasn't black. It was the sandy color of the desert, and their turbans were red, a sign of war in the desert, and their veils were pulled over their faces, hiding all but their eyes. Onur practically fell into his throne, as if it pained him to remain standing.
"You've come a long way,"
he said in his deep baritone.
"As have you,"
she nearly added, "my lord king," and was glad she hadn't.
"How is it that you, that the bitch, Sumeya's lapdog, has ended up here in the desert wastes?"
Sumeya was Chaedor's former commander in the Blade Maidens, their first warden. Chaedor had hoped the news of the battle hadn't made it this far into the desert, but stories like these, ones that shift the very sands of the desert, travelled as fast as ships could carry them. He might already know some of her reasons for fleeing Sharrakai, which left her with a choice. Should she speak the truth and hope to gain some small amount of trust, or gamble that he didn't know all of it, and that he wouldn't learn the truth before Chaedor escaped the protection of his tribe? She wasn't sure. It all depended on why Onur had left Sharrakai. Knowing the halls of the House of Kings as she did, she could make some guesses. Onur was slovenly. He was brash. He took only his own counsel and offered his with neither hesitation nor invitation. He was barely tolerated by the other kings. Had that changed? Had something made the other kings exile him, or had Onur left on his own? The former seemed unlikely. Onur was stubborn and belligerent. He would have defended his throne to the death if challenged. But what if he'd simply grown weary of his life in Sharrakai, of ruling the city with 11 other kings? Could a man like Onur not return to the desert and rule whatever tribe he wished?
"Come, child," Onur snapped. "Tell your tale."
His reaction to her hesitation, the pinched look on his face, made her decision for her. Revealing more than she needed to Onur, who rarely repaid the trust others placed in him, would be the height of foolishness.
"All I may say is that I'm on a mission from King Yusam."
Onur laughed deeply, genuinely, though on him it seemed a sort of vulgar foreplay that would lead to violent acts.
"May say? You are here in my tribe. You have entered my domain, and you'll share what I will. Now, why are you here in the desert?"
"I was on tribe Masal's lands."
"They can no longer make claim to those lands."
"They've ceded them to you."
"I've taken them. As I will take the entire eastern reach of the desert."
His brow furrowed, his eyes darkened.
"Now out with it. If you force me to ask again, we'll have these women quarter your life. Then men and God alike will see that you're made of naught but flesh and blood and bone."
"Yusam sent me into the desert the day after the battle. He shared little with me, but I believe he foresaw this meeting in his mirror. My only question is how it fits within his grand vision."
"Your only question?"
"Yes."
Chaedor had tried her best to sound confident, but there was a note of irritation in Onur's voice that worried her.
"From where I sit, there are more relevant questions, such as how you escaped the Night of Endless Swords with Cahil and Mesut in tow. How you survived while Mesut died and Cahil was almost sent to the tomb that awaits him beneath his palace. Or what, as some have whispered, had you to do with the wandering king's
death.
Anua stood, and immediately his women flanked Cheda. As Anua strode forward, his intentions clear, she dropped into a fighting stance and felt for their heartbeats. She managed to find the women's, but Onur, as strong as his should have been, eluded her completely.
Most curious to me is why the gods have seen fit to place you in my waiting palm like a glittering jewel, when all I've ever done is spit upon them and their gifts to the kings of Shanokai.
He swung one meaty fist at Cheda, a blow she easily avoided.
It's a sign as sure as the moon's in the night sky.
He swung again, and this time Cheda stepped in and drove one fist deep into his belly. She only just escaped his grasping hand, but was kicked forward by the tribeswoman behind her. Onur charged with a speed that belied his bulk and grabbed her left wrist. Her right she drove into his neck. It struck hard, with all her weight behind it, but Onur took it with little more than a cough. She tried to send the heel of her palm up and into his nose, but he snatched her hand and drew her toward him. She had only a split second to turn away before his forehead crashed into her cheek. She saw stars and took another blow to the left side of her head. One more thudding blow came in from her right, and then she was tipping down and rolling blindly along the carpets. She stumbled while trying to regain her feet to the amusement of Onur, who stood over her, a cut on his forehead, dripping blood down into his left eye and along his sweaty cheek. He grabbed the front of her dress and pulled her up until they were eye to eye.
"Do you know what tipped your hand?"
Before she could answer, another strong blow came in from his right fist, driving her down to the carpet. The world began to spin away as Onur spoke one last time.
"Yusam, the only man I halfway respected in that entire stinking city, died the night of the battle."
And then the darkness claimed her. Cheda woke to the sound of scratching. Her head felt like a smith had been using it for an anvil. Not a smith, she thought. Onur. Memories of her fight with the feasting king swam before her. Gods, how fast he'd moved. It wasn't right for an ox to move so quickly. Yet another thing the gods would one day answer for. For all the pain in her head, her limbs felt strangely numb, as if she had been thrown in an ice bath. Her hands were bound behind her, tied to what felt like an iron spike driven into the unforgiving stone beneath her. She tried to get her fingers around the spike, see if she might pull it loose, but the smallest movements made her head pound so badly she abandoned the exercise. The scratching sounds continued. She was both curious and annoyed to realize there were two sorts. One was soft, a scratching sound, like a reed pen on papyrus. The other was harsher, metallic. Both made the roof of her mouth itch, and opening her eyes brought sharp pain from the bright light. She closed them, and only after waiting a good long while for the pain to pass did she pry them open once more. She was in a tent. A small one, layered in bright, patterned carpets. Two women were in the tent with her. One sat cross-legged in the corner, writing in a book, dipping a pen into the nearby well before writing with quick, precise strokes. She gave Cheda a sour glance, but then went back to her task. The other woman sat on a stool, a sword across her lap. She was scratching something into the blade with an awl. The steel blade was dark, Cheda realized, an ebon blade. Dear gods, it was River's daughter. Years ago, Chaedor would have laughed at the thought of caring about a sword, but she and that blade had been through much together. Too much to allow some girl from the desert to carve things into its dark steel.
Leave that!
Chaedor squinted against the piercing agony that speech brought. She waited for it to subside, again sensing a strange numbness in her frame, then tried again.
You will lay that sword down now before I use it to carve things into your skin.
The woman looked up. She was several years older than Chaedor. Blue tattoos marked her forehead and framed her eyes, trailing along her cheeks and down her chin, making it look as though she were wearing a demon mask.
Speak again. You'll wish our lord had led you to the farther fields.
I said, lay that sword aside.
The two women exchanged a look. The one who was writing, the older of the two, nodded, and the other took Chaedor's sword up and stood. She used the flat of the blade to strike Chaedor's hip.
You will remain silent.
Chaedor felt for her own heartbeat. Even as battered as she was, she became attuned to it as never before. It calmed her, gave her confidence. The numbness she had felt earlier had become a prickling beneath her skin.
You're not worthy to touch that blade.
This time the woman aimed for Chaedor's face. She put no great force behind it, but she was quick. Chaedor was ready, though. She had felt the woman's intent before her arm moved. She twisted aside as River's daughter whirred past her face and struck the carpets. Rolling back onto her shoulders, Chaedor kicked upward. Her heel caught the young woman's jaw, but that was only part of her purpose. Even as she reeled away, Chaedor locked her legs around her sword arm. She pulled down, twisting her hips and legs as she went. The sword spun free, and the woman stumbled into the wall of the tent. The other woman was caught by surprise. She threw aside her book and pen and lurched to her feet. Chaedor felt her own fear and anger coursing through her. Her right hand was hot as wind-blown embers, as it had been before she'd fallen on Idris in Sharakai and beaten her bloody. Then it had been the Aesir, Hava, working through Chaedor. Hava was dead, but Kerim was not. This power was his. He was giving her what aid he could. There was something odd about his emotions, though. Regret? Sorrow? She couldn't tell, and there was no time to figure it out. She pulled hard on the rope, restraining her wrists. It held, but her hand and wrist burned the hotter for it. She tried again, and the rope snapped just as the other woman charged forward, a curving kensha held in her right hand. She'd not taken two steps before Chaedor pressed on her heart, making her cough. Her eyes widened as she stumbled, creating an opening so large Chaedor could have ridden a horse through it. Chaedor stepped in, blocked the sloppy stab of her knife, and brought her fist so hard across the woman's face her eyes glazed, even before she had struck the carpets. The younger woman was on her feet again, but she was disoriented from Chaedor's kick. She was pushing herself up off the tent wall, ungainly as a waking infant, and then Chaedor was on her. A punch to the throat to keep her from crying out, and then slipping behind her and snaking one arm around her neck. She grasped desperately at Chaedor, trying to free herself, but she seemed to know it was a lost cause, which was perhaps why she desperately flung one foot out to catch a small table holding a host of copper bowls. They clattered across the tent, surely alerting the entire camp that something was amiss. Indeed, as the woman went slack, Chaedor heard a cry of alarm. Through the tent flaps she glimpsed Onur's trunk-like legs plodding toward her. He was dragging something behind him. She picked up River's daughter and charged toward the opposite wall. Slicing down, she cut through the tough fabric with ease. Cheda sprinted toward the edges of the camp, looking for something, a horse, a skiff, she could use to escape. She had not gone 10 strides, however, when she heard a booming voice behind her.
Chedamin, Ayaneshala!
Honora had sensed her flight. Why else would he have been heading toward her tent so shortly after her attack had begun? But she could still escape into the desert. There were horses tied to a stake behind a sleek caravel. She would take one, find Karim, and return to the desert.
Flee if you wish, Honor thundered. But if you do, the one you're bonded with dies.
Cheda slowed, then stopped in her tracks. Karim. He had been the cause of her numbness. Honor had been stifling his presence, and Karim had still somehow lent her strength so that she might escape, knowing full well he would remain under Onur's control. She hadn't considered how completely the kings could dominate the Asirem, a terrible, foolish mistake on her part. She should have sent Karim far away the moment she saw Onur. She turned to find Onur stalking across the sand, dragging Karim by his rags, as if he weighed no more than a gutted lamb. The Asirim had always seemed so godlike, almost otherworldly. She'd never considered that they might succumb to trauma as mortal man did. Yet here Karim was, his limbs dragging, his head swinging awkwardly, his eyes were drunken and half-lidded. With one hand, Onur heaved Karim, tossing him to the sand at his feet. In his other hand, he held a great spear, its broad head etched with ancient sigils. He lifted it to one shoulder, the tip pointed vaguely at Karim's chest.
How very tender-hearted you are. I have thought you were bonded to this pathetic soul against your will and would be glad to be rid of him.
The spear's tip slowly pierced Karim's skin. Black blood oozed. Karim did no more than moan and twist gently away.
Leave him!
Honor raised his eyebrows.
Drop your blade.
There was fear in Cheda, strong and building that Honor would kill Karim no matter what she did. But what else could she do? She couldn't stand by and let Honor kill him, a soul who had done so much to protect her. She threw River's daughter to the sand. Onur's amused expression deepened across his flabby face.
I'd rather hoped we would cross blades. I haven't slaked my thirst on the blood of a maiden in many long years.
He shrugged and motioned to the men and women by his side to take Cheda.
Another day, then.
When Cheda's hands were bound once more, he turned and plodded away. Chapter 6 The camp moved on the day after Cheda gave herself up to Onur. She was forced to help tear down the tents and pack them onto the waiting ships. And then she was chained to the hull in the hold of their largest galleon. She hadn't been told where they were going, but she gleaned several clues as the ships were being made ready. The dour looks on everyone's faces, their worried glances toward Onur, and while Cheda was carrying things aboard the ship, she'd seen men and women training with shield and spear on the sand. Onur had led them, shouting commands, the ranks of desert soldiers moving in disciplined order. Beyond them, archers fired into dummies made of hay-stuffed canvas. Even the ballistas were being fired, some releasing grapnels, others long bolts, others clay pots that, while not alight now, would be filled with oil and lit before being launched on the enemy. tribe Salmuk was preparing for battle. The question was, battle with whom? The kings, Chayda mused. It seemed unlikely. The tribe, given enough ships, could take down a royal ship, but only if they managed to catch it and their royal clippers and yachts, unless caught off guard by ill winds, were too fast for all but the swiftest vessels in the tribe's small fleet. They might be turning to piracy, as many tribes did from time to time. It was conceivable a caravan was headed their way, and that Onur's plan was to sack it. But base piracy felt out of character for Onur. There was a third possibility, that Onur had set his sights on another tribe. That Chayda could believe. He'd established his power in the desert very quickly, and he'd surely not rest at ruling a single tribe. He'd force more, whether through reason, gold, might, or some combination of all three, to join him.
Which tribe, though? The ships are headed north, and north means Red Wind territory. The land of Tribe Masal.
Over the course of the night and the following day, Chayda tried to reach out to Karim.
She could feel him just out of reach, like the light from a bonfire over the horizon. Onur's will was smothering him, which made her wonder how in the great wide desert Karim had managed to overcome Mesut's will and bond with her. She refused to believe Onur was stronger. Mesut's resolve had not only been strong, it had been precise and righteous, things Onur might match but not exceed. Mesut had spent centuries lording it over the Asiram, though. Could Karim have learned his weaknesses and exploited them to break from Mesut and bond with Chayda? Even if he had, Karim was now as distant from her as the shores of the Austral Sea. Days passed. Her world became marked by simple meals of water and flatbread, shitting and pissing in the pot they'd provided, and the unceasing motion of the ship as it maneuvered the ever-changing dunes. 3 days into their sail, Beryl, the woman who had first found Chayda in the desert, came for her. She was unchained from the hold and led in shackles to the captain's cabin. Onur sat within. He waved Beryl away, and Chayda was alone with him. Or so she'd thought. She'd been so fixated by Onur that the form hanging from the hull to her right hadn't registered. As the door thudded closed, however, she gasped and stepped back. Karim hung there, limp, his hands and feet fixed to the hull with massive iron spikes, making him look like a puppet waiting to be taken up for its next show. Breath of the desert.
She hadn't meant to speak, especially not in front of Onur, but she couldn't help it.
How frail Karim looked.
The Asiram was so often hunched, moving with menace and a power that spoke of the desert's elder days. To see Karim reduced to an object of Onur's sick amusement shook her.
"Release him!"
she commanded. Onur was sitting on the same wooden throne he'd used in the desert tent. He eased his bulk from it and waddled around the desk.
"Soon enough."
He stood before Karim, all but ignoring Chayda.
"Curious creatures. Their chests may rise and fall, but they don't need breath."
He glanced back, his porcine eyes spearing her.
"You could take it from them. It sends them into fits of terror if you bury them away from the Adhikara. You can bleed them as well. Bleed them until there's nothing left. It comes back after a few weeks if you leave them be. And you can do it all over again."
Chayda felt sick. He'd been torturing Karim, and he wanted her to know it. But why hadn't she felt it? It was yet more proof, of his dominion over the Asirim. It was then that she noticed the object around Onur's fat wrist. She had been so shocked by the sight of Karim she hadn't noticed that he wore Misut's bracelet. Onur noted her surprise, raised his arm and examined it.
I must admit, I had doubts when I heard Misut had been killed, and more when the rumors said you were responsible. But now...
He lowered his arm and took her in from head to toe. She suppressed a shiver. His lecherous gaze felt not only foul but fervent, as if he wished to own her as he owned Karim.
They're calling that great battle in the harbour Bet Savash, the night of endless swords. I left that very night, and do you know why?
He paused, perhaps wondering how much she knew, but in this she had no idea. She shrugged, if only to keep him talking.
I found a traitor amongst our ranks. A coward who had been playing the kings against each other, in a bid to rule Sharakai on his own, or at least with fewer other kings to contend with. King Assad, or should I say, King Assad's daughter, stood by his side. She gave me this.
He pulled up the sleeve of his thawb and showed her a puckered scar.
And this.
Another just below his collarbone.
And a handful more.
A pity Nayan's knife didn't slice higher, Chayda said. With Karim's pitiful twitching, her anger was threatening to boil over. But the fact that Onur had chosen to reveal some key information wasn't lost on her. Chayda had long since guessed that her mother had killed King Azad and that the kings had chosen to replace him, through wizardry of some sort, with his daughter Nayan. It was deeply pleasing to learn she had been right, but it left one burning question. Why would Onur share this with her? Onur shrugged his massive shoulders.
Nayan was skilled, but she fell like a sack of turnips when I struck her. She did, however, manage to spill Yusam's blood all over the floors of Isan's pretty palace.
Though Onur's mouth dropped into a frown, his eyes twinkled. It was a look Chayda was beginning to associate with genuine amusement from this, the most unpleasant of kings.
Whatever the fates decided that night, Onur went on, you've touched on an important point. Nayan was one of the finest warders the maidens have ever seen. She's not just a fine warrior, but a leader. Those trained in the arts of war are rare. Those gifted at it, even rarer. As young as you are, I see much of her in you.
A pause.
There is a thirst in you. Is there not to kill more of the kings?
Next to her, Karim squirmed and Chayda's insides with him.
Just get on with it.
A flash of annoyance marred Onur's features as he considered her.
You have the same fire as your mother. She wished for the downfall of the kings, yes? And she was not wholly unsuccessful. She took Azad's life before she died.
He leaned back, his fingers interlacing over the roundness of his belly.
And now comes her daughter, searching for vengeance.
Chayda felt her face drain of blood. Onur, of course, knew that Aya had assassinated Azad, all the kings knew. But until now, only Isan had pieced together the clues that tied Aya to Chayda. Did the other kings know as well? Likely so, but in the end she supposed it mattered little. More important for now was the fact that Honor was dangling the information before her like bait in a snare. Could it be? Had Aya pretended to love him in order to have Cheda? Had Cheda a handful of sand, she would have lifted it to her lips right then and there and sifted it through her fingers. Please, Nalame, if there was ever a thing you would grant me this.
Do you know who my father is?
She asked, afraid of the answer but refusing to hide from it.
I do,
he replied, letting the words sit between them like a golden chest waiting to be opened.
Who is he, then?
His rumbling chuckle filled the cabin.
That's too valuable to give up for so little from you.
Then send me back to the hold. I tire of your stench, and I would sooner die than stand by your side as you lay ruin upon the desert.
I've heard rashness is your greatest weakness. Don't let it be your downfall.
He cast his gaze toward the hull, beyond which lay the bulk of the tribe's ships.
Train these savages how to swing a sword. Prepare them to march on Sharakai. Help me knock the kings from their merry perches atop Turiat, and watch them fall like conies struck through with arrows.
I want you to fall as well.
His face turned sour.
If you truly wish to avenge your mother's death, set that aside. Come with me and command an army. Come with me and watch kings take their last breath. The coward, Kahil, the snake Isan, the mighty king of swords, even Kiral, king of kings.
And if I decide to take a sword to your throat first?
Then it will be a day for the ages, will it not? All the gods of the desert will come to observe.
She was shocked to see a grudging respect in his gaze.
There would be no shame in dying that way for either of us.
But why would the tribes follow you, a king they've loathed all their lives?
Because I'm giving them what they want. Revenge. The strongest motivator of man. The desert people may loathe me, but only as a vague notion of king. Their hatred for Sharakai lives in their bones. They're forced to abide by the city's rule, and so the amber jewel has become a symbol of all they hate. Permanence. The influence of foreign powers. The chanting of the ways of the desert and the raping of its resources. They hate that far more than they hate any one king. And if I can promise them the city will fall, then what does it matter that I once ruled it?
Why? Jade asked. Why share all this with me? Why not tell the other kings how Isan and Azad had betrayed them and watched them fight from within?
I never said the other was Isan.
No, but it was.
As he worked his tongue across his yellow teeth, Honor considered her more carefully.
You discovered much in your time as a maiden.
Answer me. Why not tell the other kings?
Because I want them at full strength when I tear them apart. The kings crushed the desert tribes 4 centuries ago. Let us see what happens when I set that conflict alight once more.
A knock came at the cabin door, but Honor ignored it.
Say that you will stand by my side. Tear down the walls of Sharakai with me. Avenge your mother.
Gods help her. Jada actually considered it.
Honor was building an army. She might free Karim and use Honor, even as he hoped to use her. She could still do all she hoped to do, but for once from a position of power instead of weakness.
You'll even have your Aesir back.
An echo of what she had been thinking, and yet the words were like cold water to her face. She turned to look at Karim, whose head was turned to one side, lifting slightly as if he were trying to look at Chayda but couldn't summon the strength to do so.
You would give me my Aesir.
And more if you wish. Only tell me how many you can safely bond with.
More of them. As if the Aesirim were his. His playthings to distribute as he saw fit.
As the knock at the door came again, more urgently, Chayda moved to the wall, the chains of her fetters clanking. She took Karim's head in her hands and lifted him up until she was gazing into his eyes. His eyes were clouded but seemed to focus on her.
Blood of my blood,
she whispered. Karim's eyes closed, fluttered, opened again. Words were on his lips, but nothing came. It didn't matter, though.
Forgive me for what I'm about to do,
she whispered, then turned and spat on the deck between her and Honor.
You are a coward, an enemy of my people, and I would never fight for you.
Honor's face went red, his features screwed up in anger. He stepped forward, grabbed for Chayda's chains. She backed away, but he kept coming, and there was nowhere for her to go. He backhanded her, then followed her down to the floor, raining blows down with his meaty fists. A third knock came. Someone spoke in a rush.
My lord king, sails have been spotted on the horizon.
Honor's movements slowed. His breath came heavy as he stared at her, spittle rolling from his mouth.
You'll see things differently when I have more of his kind in my power.
Jada said nothing as he dragged her to a stand in one great heave and shoved her out onto the deck of the ship. Her ankles still shackled, she spilled across it, falling near Beryl's feet.
Put her back in the hold.
Honor spat, then lumbered past her, surveying the way ahead, where the sails from several dozen ships made a sawtooth pattern over the otherwise smooth horizon.
Come,
Beryl said in a low voice. She pulled Chayda not so roughly as Chayda might have expected, and led her below decks. Chapter 7 Chayda was chained below decks, alone in the hold as Honor's battle against tribe Masal neared. Through the deck above she heard orders being called more crisply. The nervousness in their voices was plain. The tribes were no strangers to battle, but this was something altogether different. Not a raid to steal horses or ships or cargo, but war. And it had been generations since such a conflict had racked the desert. Honor wanted to subjugate the Red Wind of Tribe Masal. If he was successful, and with a surprise attack and overwhelming numbers, Chayda had no reason to think he wouldn't be. He would move on quickly to the burning hands of Tribe Kadri, the standing stones of Tribe Ebros, or the rushing waters of Tribe Kenan. Just another cruel desert overlord. As she had over the past several days, she reached out to Karim, but she still felt little save his pain, which, while bright, was like peering at a burning brand through a shroud of canvas.
I'm sorry, she said. I wish you hadn't been found.
She heard no reply. Feet pounded over the deck as a new flurry of orders came from above. The ship tilted sharply as it adjusted course and heeled so far to the starboard side she thought it would tip over. But a moment later it was thrown to the other direction and Chayda was slammed back against the hull. The battle began a short while later. The ballista and catapult crews shouted as they identified targets or reloaded. The sound of breaking pottery was followed by a whoosh of fire. Drops of fiery liquid dripped down from the deck, landing on Chayda's shoulder. She shifted away and smothered the fire as shouts of pain came from all about. Thankfully, blue sand drifted gently down, a dousing agent for the fire. The battle continued, the ship heeling this way, then that. The thud of arrows came, and more breaking pots, followed by people shouting to douse the flames. Chayda felt like a bean in a rattle. She'd grown accustomed to sailing as a maiden, but she'd never been through anything like this. The inability to anticipate the ship's movements was making her sick. Suddenly, the ship slowed, and she was thrown forward. The chains securing her went tight, and she slapped against the hull. They'd either dropped the rake, a device sometimes used to slow enemy ships after grapnels had been thrown across their rigging, or the same had been done to this ship. Whatever the case, a battle was soon raging across the deck above. Clomping footsteps resounded and swords rang out, followed by a symphony of pain and anger and desperation. Sometimes it came louder, the combat happening directly above her. At other times it dwindled, but it was clear the ship was in a fight for its life. Several times she heard Honor rage, almost growl as he fought.
Honor is here,
she heard above the clash of the battle.
Honor is...
The voice was cut off with a gurgle. On the far side of the hold, the hatch was thrown back. Two soldiers, both women, dropped down with swords in hand, but it was so dark, Chayda couldn't tell whether they were of tribe Salmuk or tribe Masal, whom Honor was here to conquer.
Who are you?
Chayda asked, hating that fear had bled into her voice.
Be quiet, said the nearer of the two. If we're found, all three of us will be killed.
It was Beryl, Chayda realized.
But why would she...
Is it true?
Beryl went on, almost breathless.
Are you the White Wolf? Did you kill the kings, as Honor said?
What? Why are you asking?
Is it true?
There was no reason to hide it.
Yes, it's true.
Kulishan and Mesut and Cahil.
No, not Cahil. He escaped.
But you fought him.
And wounded him.
Beryl and the other woman shared a look, after which Beryl nodded. When the other woman did too, Beryl took up the chain that secured Chayda to the hull.
Help us, she said. We need to make it look like you escaped on your own.
As Beryl gripped the chains, the other woman, the one Chayda had knocked unconscious before cutting a hole in the tent, slipped around Chayda to her left and took the chain in both hands as well. Confused but seeing no reason to deny them, Chayda helped as they began pulling on the chain. It took some doing. The three of them strained mightily, but then the bolt finally gave and all three of them flew backward.
Now,
Beryl said, taking a key and unlocking the manacles.
Head southwest. In 2 days' walk, you'll find a hill with an old abandoned tower and a well beneath it.
From around her waist, she unbuckled a sword belt. She was wearing two, Chayda realized, and one held River's daughter. Chayda buckled it on, realizing how very good it felt to have her sword back.
Why are you doing this?
Beryl took a skin of water and slipped it over Chader's neck.
A skiff will come for you bearing a blue pennant. It will take you to the Moonless Host.
Chader gripped her wrists.
Why are you doing this?
Beryl's eyes were filled with sudden passion.
Because you are blood of my blood.
The words struck Chader like a hammer.
Blood of my blood.
Beryl was one of the 13th tribe. It explained her actions, but more than this, it made Chader feel connected to the desert tribes more than she ever had before.
I'm sorry I couldn't free you before you reached Onor. Had I known...
Chader shook her head.
You couldn't have known.
She gripped Beryl's hands and said,
Thank you.
Thank me by fulfilling your vow to kill the kings of Sharikai. Now come.
She motioned to the hatch that led down into the bowels of the ship where, surely she meant for Chader to leave through the access hatch along the bottom of the ship's hull. But Chader refused to follow.
I can't leave without Kerim.
He is lost to you.
No, he isn't, and he's leaving with me.
Beryl looked to the other woman, who merely shrugged.
Very well. But take this.
She unwrapped her turban and quickly wrapped it around Chader's head in the Salmuk style. Then they were off. Beryl leading the way up the ladder to the deck. Chader followed, her heart beating fiercely in case they were seen. But the ship was nearly empty. Four crewmen stood on the foredeck, throwing sand on a fire still raging over the deck. One man stood on the vulture's nest atop the main mast. When he saw Beryl and Chader heading for the captain's cabin, Chader thought they'd been found out, but the man merely nodded. They entered the cabin and found Kerim, still nailed to the hull. They rummaged through Onur's desk until they found an old sextant, which they used to pry the nails free. Chader tried to be careful with Kerim's skin, but there was simply no way to avoid harming him, so she pulled harder.
I'm sorry,
she said as she laid Kerim down, the black blood oozing from his wounds, staining the bright golden carpet. Kerim, eyelids heavy, his breath terribly weak, made no reply. She wasn't even sure he could. Leaving him there, she returned to the desk and hunted through the lower drawers, then the nearby shelves.
Beryl, I need the bracelet as well, the one with the onyx stone.
The two of them tore through the cabin as quickly as they could, opening the chest in the corner, looking through the drawers in the desk and beneath the bunk, but it wasn't there.
He must have taken it into battle with him, Beryl said.
She'd no sooner spoken than Chader looked up. She could feel something, small and dark and angry, like a secret door to an oubliette. She felt along the cabin's roof, moving the boards. The closer she came to it, the more certain she was of its location. One of the boards popped loose, revealing a hidden compartment. Within was a bag with coins, a woman's ring, and the bracelet.
How?
Beryl asked, but then shook her head.
Never mind. We must hurry.
Chader stuffed the bag inside her dress and rushed to Karim's side. She lifted him up and carried him to the shuttered windows at the rear of the cabin. He hardly moved. After setting him on the sill, she gave his weight over to Beryl, then climbed out of the window and leapt to the ground. Beryl lowered him down, and Chader caught him as best she could, the two of them collapsing to the sand.
When you see Ishak, Beryl said, tell him Onor was hunting for something in our tribe. He never told me what, but I believe he hopes to find it among the treasures of Tribe Masar.
Very well,
Chader said, wondering what it might be. As quickly as she could, She bore Kerim away from the conflict, praying to Nalame for the darkness and the blowing sand to hide her.
Hold on, Kerim. We're nearly safe.
It was a horrible lie. They were anything but safe. But soon enough, they were beyond the next dune, and soon after that, the sun had fallen. She headed southwest, walking as far as she could manage before laying Kerim down in the trough between two dunes. As the stars brightened on a moonless night, Chayda held Kerim as he shivered. Chayda took the stairs down into the earth, unwinding her turban and wrapping it around her shoulders. The earth's chill embraced her like a lost love, welcoming after so long in the desert. It was quiet beneath the tower Beryl had described. Lonely. It felt as if she were walking into a catacomb to find her own tomb. The stairs led to a natural cavern, utterly black, save for the stairwell's faded smudge of ash grey behind and above her. She moved slowly, warding her way forward, then heard it. The drip of water. It came rhythmically, oddly timed to her every third footfall, as if a lost god were weaving a spell to draw her near. When her boots splashed into water, she crouched and reached out, finding a shallow pool cold to the touch. She took a small mouthful. It tasted of minerals and sulfur, but was drinkable all the same. With her knees in the water, she drank deeply, then cupped the water and splashed her face over and over, cooling her skin and washing away the dirt and grime of the desert. Stepping deeper into the pool, she lay in the water, rolled over, soaked her dress in it before simply floating, arms out, staring into the darkness. It felt like the passage to the farther fields to simply sit here and pretend she was not a part of the world above. But then the dripping seemed to come louder. It was only a trick of the mind, as if the lost god had grown bored with her presence and was telling her to return to the sun, to leave this place or suffer his wrath. As much as Chayda might wish to sever her ties to the troubles of the world, she had no choice. She was woven into the desert's story as much as Anur, as King Isan, as Masid, and Queen Meriam and Kiral, the King of Kings. And Kerim and the other Asiram. She stayed a long while, but thoughts of Kerim who waited for her above, alone and in pain, sobered her, and she made ready to return to him. She drank more water, filled her water skin, then made the climb back up to the surface, where she found him lying exactly where she'd left him, in one corner of the tower's square interior. He was facing her, but his eyes wouldn't focus. Nor did he move as she knelt by his side and placed a hand on his shoulder. She knew better than to offer him water. The Asiram neither ate nor drank, except when forced to by the kings. "My mother used to go to the blooming fields," she said, if only to take her mind from the grisly curse the desert gods had lain across the shoulders of the Asiram. "She'd bring back the blooms and press them in a book." A book Chayda had lost when she had fled Sharakai. "How I miss it. The heft of it was so like the weight of my mother's hand in mine," Chayda reminisced, flashes of memories playing in her mind's eye, holding her mother's hand as they went to the well, or watching as she bartered for salt and lemons from Sehan, or shivering by her side in their shared bed, trying to fall asleep while the Asiram howled their way closer to Sharakai. "But it's gone now. Given back to the desert." She stroked Kerim's bald head. His eyes were slits, the pain within him great. "Still," she went on, hoping to draw his mind away from memories of his torture at the hands of Anur. That book held three of the riddles.